Okay, I'm going to speak on the question, has science disproved God? And to reassure the Christians who've invited me, the answer is going to be no. But I did once used to think that the answer was yes. So when I was 18, going up to Cambridge to study natural sciences, I used to think that science meant that Christianity was no longer credible for intelligent people. And in fact, when I was 18, I wrote a poem to express my contempt for Christianity. Now, you have to realise that I was a science student, not an English literature student, and so my poem is rather limited in terms of merit, but I still remember how it goes, and it goes like this. Some folks seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. Okay, that was it. That was the sum total of my literary output. But it just expresses something of how I felt about Christians. It must be that they just don't understand basic biology. I mean, yeah, sure, people used to believe that God gave us life, kind of magically, but now we understand about cell division and mitosis and that kind of thing. We understand how it happens. People used to think that God made it rain with a big watering can in the sky, but now we understand about the water cycle, evaporation, condensation, we know how it happens. People used to think that God made us magically stick to the ground, but then we discovered the theory of gravity. We understand how it happens. And so surely now is time to grow up a bit intellectually. Stop holding on to those medieval, outdated ideas of God. You may know that Richard Dawkins has described or likened Christian belief to belief in the tooth fairy. He says, all very well when you're 8 or 9, putting a tooth under your pillow and expecting some cash in the morning, but it becomes a little bit embarrassing if you're still doing that when you're age 19 or 20. It's time to grow up a bit and throw off these superstitions. Well, that's what I thought. I thought that belief in God, in my little poem, was a bit like throwing money into the water, into a wishing well, and hoping that tomorrow would turn out better because of it. Whereas, of course, I knew, as a cynical 18-year-old, that the council just came along and harvested the coins and added it to their budget. Well, about a month after writing that poem, I became a Christian. And everything in my life turned upside down. It was the result of meeting some Christian friends at university, some real Christians, as I call them now. I'd had kind of churchy friends before. I'd been nominally along to church a few times. I was christened, that kind of thing. But the first time I met Christians who actually lived as though God was real. And I was interested, I was attracted by their lives, I asked some questions, and to cut a long story short, I became convinced that it was true. But I was still doing a science degree. I finished my science degree. I went on, as Nick said, to do some further science on ears. But still a scientist, but now believing that the world that we live in was designed by a personal good creator. Actually, I have to say that makes studying ears more exciting. So ears are, I'm not going to talk about ears for the next 25 minutes, although I could if you wanted me to, but ears are pretty amazing. Some of the things that your ear is capable of doing is better even now than the most advanced computers. Some of the things that you do, just when you hear me speak now, the amount of processing going on in your brain is more advanced than most computers. And it was a great encouragement to me to believe that there was a God who had made it that brilliant. So I discovered some new pathway, some new mechanism, to think there is a God who designed us to be able to hear this amazingly well. That was an encouragement. But I would say there was no conflict for me believing those things about a God and doing experiments to understand the world that he'd made. And I was in good company. So maybe you recognize some of these names, people like Charles Babbage, who built the first mechanical computer, or Robert Boyle, who came up with his annoying gas laws. If you did A-level chemistry, you had to learn those. Isaac Newton, who formulated the theory of gravitation. Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity. Louis Pasteur, who discovered bacteria, and many others. Scientists, some of the greatest scientists of history, at the same time committed Christians. In fact, according to Sir Alfred North Whitehead, the historian and philosopher of science, it was because people believed in God that they got started doing science in the first place. This is what he says. He says, mankind became scientific because they looked for law in nature. And they looked for law in nature because they believed in a law giver. In other words, if people 200 years ago had believed, as some people believe today, that the world is basically just random, just a series of accidents, they would never have bothered looking for order and design in it in the first place. It was because they believed there was an intelligence behind the world that they believed it was worth trying to understand the world intelligently. Certainly if you read some of Isaac Newton's writings, you'll find that his belief in a creator who put things together intentionally was absolutely fundamental to his experiments on gravity and his conclusions in that regard. So many people at the same time, great scientists, at the same time Christians. But you might say, okay, well those are all old names of science. What about nowadays? What about now we've put man on the moon and we now understand about the human genetic sequences? Maybe now it's time to get rid of belief in God. But actually even today, some of the leading scientists of today are at the same time committed Christians. So the very same year that Richard Dawkins brought out his book, The God Delusion, a man called Francis Collins, who was the director of the Human Genome Project, the project responsible for sequencing the human DNA, the same year as Richard Dawkins brought out The God Delusion, he brought out his book, The Language of God, which he explains his belief in the Christian God. I joined a church in Cambridge shortly after I became a Christian. I discovered a member of the church, one of the leadership of the church, was Professor Bob White, Professor of Geophysics. I'd always heard it said that geologists couldn't believe in Christianity because they all knew about the fossils and all that kind of thing. Well, Bob White knows more about geology than most people on the planet, and he was a devoted follower of Jesus at my church at university. In other words, what I want to say to you today is that I don't think it's as obvious as an either-or, science or Jesus. It's not an either-or because too many people believe in both and. Not everyone believes in both, but a sizable number believe in both, who know what they're talking about when it comes to science. But undoubtedly there is a battle going on in our culture, in our media, on the sides of our buses. If you remember those atheist bus slogans a few years ago, there's probably no God. I love those slogans. I think they were a bit of an own goal because the word probably, and people started to wonder, what if there is a God? And people started coming to church saying, well, I just wondered whether there was one after all. And so, you know, thanks for the free advertising, Richard Dawkins and co. But you can't help but notice that there is a kind of militant atheistic movement around today. The buses, the God Delusion book, the radio interviews. The latest one was Stephen Hawking. If you came across this book, The Grand Design, or some of the debates about it on Radio 4. Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist, now saying that he sees no need to believe in God. And it's trumpeted all over the media. There is a conflict going on. But I want to suggest this evening that it isn't a conflict between science on the one hand and the message of the Bible on the other, but rather it is a conflict between two different belief systems, two different philosophies, two different worldviews, two different faiths, if I can call them that. Now, I know that would make Richard Dawkins very cross because he doesn't believe that he's a man of faith. And yet it's very interesting, as you read a book like The God Delusion, the number of times Richard Dawkins will say, I believe such and such, and they're making an assertion without giving any scientific backing for it. In some ways, a profoundly religious, evangelistic book. And there is a conflict between the faith, the worldview of someone like Richard Dawkins, and the faith of the Bible. And what I want to do in the time we have remaining is to explain the two different views to you, and then do what I think someone scientifically responsible ought to do, which is to ask which one makes most sense of the facts. Let me just outline them for you. So Richard Dawkins' religion, or his faith, which you wouldn't call a faith, is called naturalism. Naturalism. That is the philosophy that matter and chance are all that there is. So Carl Sagan, the cosmologist, he once said, in a parody of the Bible statement that God was and is to come, Carl Sagan said, no, the cosmos was and is to come. All there's ever been, all there ever will be, just matter and chance. In fact, if you believe Stephen Hawking, he says all there ever was in the beginning was just the law of gravity. That's absolutely all. If you have the law of gravity, you can get everything else from it, according to this book. To put the same idea in different words, Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, slightly depressingly, he once said, "Mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust." How makes you feel? Or even more depressingly, a French guy, the French always do it better when it comes to being depressing, Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, he once said, "Every living thing was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance." Pretty depressing, but that is his philosophy, that all that there is randomness, is matter, is the laws of physics. And that is in conflict with the worldview of the Bible. And I want to give it to you in the Bible's own words. So I'm just giving you a kind of specially persuasive, edited version of the Bible. I thought I'd give it to you straight from the Bible. And if you turn over your little slip that you've got on your place, on the back of it you'll see there's an excerpt from the New Testament. And this is taken from a speech that the Apostle Paul, one of Jesus' followers, a speech that Paul gave in Athens in the first century. Now, Athens was the kind of first century intellectual capital, and people used to sit around and debate the latest ideas. And we're told that Paul in Athens got speaking to some Stoic and Epicurean philosophers. Now, I don't know much about philosophy, but I looked it up in a dictionary, and apparently the Stoics believed that the gods were so remote as to make really no difference in human life, that basically life was down to chance and random events that happened to you, and there was no survival after death. So in some ways, Stoics of that day were a little bit like naturalists of nowadays. And this is what Paul says to them, explaining the Christian view of the world. And maybe you could look down and read it with me. "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything." Let's just pause there for a moment. You see, naturalism, it will grant a place for religion in the world. If you say to Richard Dawkins, "Does religion exist?" Of course it does. Yeah, it's a global phenomenon. Hundreds of people believe stuff. But if you say to Richard Dawkins, "Can you explain God to us?" He'd say, "Sure, God is an idea that mankind has come up with. God is our creation." Actually, that's what the Stoics and Epicureans were doing as well in Athens in the first century. They believed in gods, but they made them. You see, you want a god, you go down to the silversmith. "Can you make us a god? Here's some silver." And he carves it and makes it into a face on it and makes it into your favourite god, whatever it is. And then you've made that god. Now you need somewhere for that god to live. So you make a temple for him to live in. And then you've got to help that god out because obviously he's pretty needy. And so you've got to go and give him sacrifices or food or whatever it is. And Paul says, you've got it absolutely the wrong way round. It's not that we made God, but that he made us. It's not that we need to make him a temple, because otherwise he'd have nowhere to live. He made us a world, otherwise we'd have nowhere to live. It's not that he's kind of needy, and you know, the kind of advert that you sometimes get, "Oh, please come to church because God's lonely and he needs your help," and we come to kind of give God a bit of a break. No, it's not God who needs us. We're the ones who need him. Because he himself gives all man life and breath and everything. You see how the Christian view is absolutely the opposite of the Stoic or the naturalist view. Let me just read on. Verse 26. "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Even as some of your own poets have said, we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead." And we're told in Luke's account that as Paul speaks about the resurrection of the dead, some people scoffed And other people said, we want to hear more about this. Maybe those will be the reactions here this evening. Now, this is a very different view of the world to the naturalist one. The world's got no God, it's just atoms. It came about randomly. There is a God who made the world and everything in it, who made us. Two very different views. And what I want to do now, as I said, is to compare them and to ask which one makes most sense of the facts. Which one makes most sense? Now, I want to compare them in three different ways. Firstly, which one makes most sense of, and I'm going to use a very controversial word, which one makes most sense of design in the world? Now, if you've read in the debates about this in the newspapers, you'll know that is a very controversial word to use. But at least let's accept that everyone agrees that the world looks as though it was designed. Sir Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, he once said that the idea of random chance coming up with the kind of world that we live in, it's a bit like saying that a whirlwind went through a junkyard and just by accident came up with a 747. It doesn't seem very likely that this world just happened by chance. It looks designed. But according to naturalists like Richard Dawkins, design is just a trick that our DNA has played on us. It's just an illusion. This is what he says in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was required reading for us when we went up to university. Design, he puts in inverted commas to show his contempt for the idea, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection. The blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind, has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. And that was the title of his book. In other words, the world isn't really designed, it's just an illusion. Paul says, the Bible says, now the world was designed by an intelligent personal God who wanted to know us. Now, which one makes most sense of the data? I want to take the Big Bang Theory as our starting point. And the view of inflation, which is the theory about exactly what happened at the very beginning of the universe in the Big Bang Theory. Now, a man called Alan Guth, who is the author of this view, a very eminent physicist, is not a Christian, but this is a view that most physicists subscribe to. He explains that at the very beginning of the universe, the expansion rate has got to be exactly right. If at the Big Bang the universe expanded too quickly, then all you would have in the universe would be hydrogen atoms, each one separated by millions of miles of vacuum. So nothing any bigger than hydrogen. No planets, no stars, no helium, no carbon, no life, just gas. That's all you'd have. On the other hand, if the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it. And the universe would appear, Big Bang, and then it would collapse under itself, under gravity, the Big Crunch. Big Bang, Big Crunch, even before you have 1 second on the clock. So to have any kind of universe of the kind that we live in, that's got stuff bigger than hydrogen, that lasts longer than a second, the expansion rate of the universe has got to be extraordinarily finely tuned. Alan Guth calculates it to within 1 part in 10 to the 70. Now, I don't know whether you get on the bookies, hopefully the Christians don't, but that's not very good odds, okay? And if you want an illustration to help you picture that, imagine covering the planet with 5 penny pieces, stacking them to a depth of the distance between here and the moon. Yes, I know there's not enough metal to do that, but if there were, and paint one of them red, blindfold your girlfriend or your wife, your husband, get him to pick one at random. He picks the red one, that's 1 in 10 to the 70. In other words, very, 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 very unlikely. Now, the naturalist has got a real problem here, because he says that the universe is just chance. But it looks like very, very, very unlikely chance, ridiculously unlikely chance. The Christian says, no, that it's no wonder that the expansion rate at the Big Bang was exactly right. And any number of other amazing fine-tuning properties of the world, because that's the way that God designed it to be. Now, just in case you think I'm making a specious argument for the sake of Christianity, let me tell you that the naturalists know about this problem, and it really is a problem for their view. So in Richard Dawkins' book, he has a whole section devoted to the so-called fine-tuning of the universe. And Stephen Hawking deals with it in this book. His solution is to suggest that actually we live in a multiverse. And that's the kind of trendy word of the day. And what he means by that is that there are infinitely many universes, because if you throw the dice infinitely many times, then eventually every number is going to come up sooner or later. And so he says, look, there's infinitely many universes, so it's not surprising that one of the universes worked. And that's an interesting idea, but actually I've got a problem with it. And the problem is that it isn't science. Here's a quote from the review of Hawking's book in the journal Nature, the preeminent science journal. This is what the review says. Again, not by a Christian at all. He says, the multiverse is possibly the most important idea of our time, but it gives me a headache. Is it science if we cannot test it? And of course, that is a very shrewd observation, because by definition, there is nothing about the world that enables you to test the theory that there are infinitely many universes. We just live in this one. In fact, the idea of a multiverse is, by definition, a speculation, a belief, a faith, if you like, to try and explain why it is that this universe got so lucky. When you think about it, I think the idea of a multiverse actually requires quite a lot of faith. I think it creates quite a lot of problems conceptually. I was just doing a thought experiment with myself. If there's infinitely many universes, the idea is that no random number was ever lucky, because it was going to happen somewhere. You throw infinitely many dices, you get infinitely many worlds. That means that every possible universe exists somewhere. That means if you played Monopoly last week, that means there is a version of the universe where you got Park Lane, and a version of the universe where you didn't, and a version of the universe where your sister landed on it, and a version of the universe where she didn't, and a version where she landed on it twice, and basically everything that happens to you in the world was just going to happen, but it also didn't happen. You see? That's quite weird, isn't it? So that means there's a version of the universe somewhere where I drop dead now at this point in the talk. Maybe you're hoping that you're in that version of the universe now. And there's a version of the universe where I don't. And everything that happens, both happened and didn't happen, somewhere in the millions of infinitely many. Well, that really takes a lot of faith in my mind. But it is a faith position. And the alternative one is this, to say, well, look, the reason that the universe was just right is because there was a God who designed it just right. The God who made the world and everything in it just as he wanted it to be. So firstly, design. There's other things we could talk about under that heading. But that's just one illustration, the Big Bang Theory. Design. Secondly, human life and existence. Which one makes most sense of human life? Now, at this point, I'm going to explain that I think naturalism doesn't make any sense of the kind of lives that we live. But let me just say, I realise that doesn't actually make it false. It might be that the world really is as depressing as the way the naturalists think it is. But I just want to use this argument in case there's someone here who is very comfortably a naturalist. You know, I don't have to believe in God. I don't have any inconveniences of having to worry about someone that I owe my life to. I like to be a naturalist. I think a naturalism is a very attractive philosophy because it lets us off the hook. If there's a God, there's big questions about how do I relate to him? What have I done with him? If there's no God, I can just, as the slogan say on the buses, sit back and enjoy life. Well, I want to persuade you that if you're going to be a naturalist, actually you shouldn't be enjoying life at all. Let me read to you from this book, Straw Dogs, which is by John Gray. He's the professor of European thought at the London School of Economics. Apparently, Tony Blair's favourite philosopher. So maybe that commends him to you, or maybe that puts you off, I don't know. This is what he says. He's taking naturalists to task for failing to take their theory through to its logical conclusion. And he says this. We must realise that, the liberal societies of the West still pay lip service to and present as a basis for morality a disgusting leftover of Judeo-Christian religiosity. Man must set this error aside and realise that he lives like a gypsy on the boundary of an alien world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his suffering and his crimes. I think that's very well put. You see, if you're a consistent naturalist, stop holding on to these leftover ideas that we got from Judeo-Christian heritage, that life matters. Stop holding on to that. You've got to realise, if you're a naturalist, that the world is deaf to your music, indifferent to your hopes, and to your sufferings and to your crimes. Let me just illustrate. What would you say as a consistent naturalist to a mother whose teenage son had been knocked over down a country lane on his bike and died, which is what happened to one of my mum's friends? What would you say? Unlucky. No, it's just the way that the atoms of the universe happen to bump into one another today. It's all that you can say if you want to be consistent. The universe is indifferent to your suffering. It doesn't care. It's impersonal. It's random. Or what about to your crimes? I want to tell you about a conversation I had during my PhD. I always used to get a hard time at coffee time for being the loony Christian, and people would always tease me. And mostly I'd lose the argument. I want to tell you about the one time that I won it. Hey, I'm doing the talk, I can cheese. The one time I had an argument with one of the lecturers called Kate, who I got on really well with, but I said to her, look, Kate, if you're right about the universe, can you tell me why killing you would be wrong? In particular, why would it be any different to cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast? All I'd be doing in both cases is just rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, the same kind of thing. What's the difference? Well, she thought about it for a moment. She said, well, my mother would be upset. It's a good answer. But I said, but Kate, what's upset? Upset is just the increase in the concentration of a chemical in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. Now, I wasn't trying to be harsh. That was what she thought about what a human being is. You see, it doesn't matter. Suffering doesn't matter. Crime doesn't matter. Nothing matters because it's just random at rock bottom. Psychology, or sociology, relationships reduce to psychology. Psychology reduces to biology. Biology reduces to chemistry. Chemistry reduces to physics. Physics reduces to the law of gravity, and that's all that there is. It doesn't matter. Whereas the Christian view is that human beings matter very much. Because God made us. Just look again down at that slip that you had. Look at verse 27, about a third of the way down. God made us in order that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Now that is a breathtaking thought. The idea that there is a God who made us who actually wants to know us. And human life matters because at heart it is a relational thing. And the power that was behind the universe wanted a relationship with the creatures he made. But the trouble with relationships is that science is out of its depth. See, there's not anything wrong with science. Science is a very powerful tool. But science cannot tell you everything that's important about the world. Supposing, for example, that you wanted to get to know someone in a relationship. Now, I very much doubt, those of you here who are married, I very much doubt that on your first date, you said to your prospective husband or wife, give me a DNA sample and that will be enough. And I'll go away to the lab and I'll let you know in a few weeks' time. I very much doubt you did that. Science is very limited when it comes to getting to know people. I mean, imagine you wanted to get to know me. And maybe you don't as a result of this talk, but if you did, and all you could go on was what you could tell from scientific experiments, what could you tell? Well, you could do scanning electron microscopy on the fibers on my genes, and you could work out maybe which fibers I picked up from which train lines on the way here. You could determine my route. You could do DNA fingerprinting, and you could tell me whether I'm related to any known criminals or whether I'm going to die prematurely from any known genetic diseases. You could do gas chromatography under my armpit and tell me what deodorant I'm wearing and whether or not it's working under the slightly stressful conditions. And that is pretty much all that you could say. You couldn't say what my name was. You couldn't say what I love and what I hate, what makes me laugh and what makes me cry, who I care about. Almost nothing of any importance in terms of getting to know me personally. It's not that science is not important, but science cannot tell you everything that matters about the world. And when it comes to a relationship with God, well, science is even more out of its depth, isn't it? Because how do you measure him? If he's everywhere, how do you get him out of the apparatus to take a null reading for a control? You cannot know God just by your experiments. You certainly cannot know him personally. But the Christian message is that God has taken the initiative to make himself known. This is our third and final point. God has made himself known in the person of Jesus Christ. He describes it in this little speech as proof or assurance. God has given proof of this to everyone by raising this man from the dead. And I want to ask in closing, which one of these philosophies makes most sense of the life, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ? Now, according to naturalism, miracles like the resurrection are impossible because all there is in the world is matter and the fixed laws of physics. And so Richard Dawkins, when he discusses the resurrection of Jesus, he discusses it only once in his book and then says it cannot have happened, being in the very nature of the case a contradiction of the laws of science. I think that's quite right. I think what he means is it cannot have happened, being in the very nature of the case a contradiction in my belief in naturalism. See, if the resurrection happened, then naturalism has to go. Can't explain that. He says the resurrection's got to go, because he's going to hold on by blind faith to his religious convictions, no matter what the evidence says. If the resurrection happened, naturalism has to go. It's proof that there is a God who made us, that he wants to know us, that it's time to stop playing games with him, that we need to turn back to him and acknowledge him. And of this he's given proof to all by raising him from the dead. Let me tell you, that was an enormous surprise to me as an undergraduate, to discover that Christianity wasn't just a matter of believing stuff because you were kind of believing kind of person. I thought it was all about enjoying stained glass windows and singing hymns, and if you closed your eyes and made a wish, somehow convincing yourself in the absence of any data that there was a God behind the whole show. It's a great surprise to me to discover at the heart of the Christian message evidence, facts about this person, Jesus Christ, about his life, his death, supremely his resurrection. And as I looked into that, I began to be convinced that this was true, that this was not a random world that we lived in, but a world lovingly made by a designer God. That our lives were not random events, that where suffering and crime didn't matter, but they were lives created by God who wanted to know us. And that Jesus Christ wasn't just a figure of history who hadn't done any of the miracles attributed to him, but was the God who made the world come to introduce himself in person. And that was the most important discovery I've ever made, and I hope that some of you will make it too. I'm very, very grateful for your time listening, and I'm going to hand back over to Nick, who'll tell us what happens next.